Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
A Catalan to the tips of his fingers, Ricard Rofes is the winemaker at Scala Dei in Priorat, in charge of one of Spain's greatest historic properties. A lover of Garnacha, Ricard talked to me about monks, heretics, cooperatives, slate soils, and why his native region is returning to its roots after taking a wrong turn towards Bordeaux in the 1990s. Hey, Ricard, how are you?
Fine, thanks. You? How are you?
Fantastic. Where are you?
I'm at home in Priorat, in my parents' house.
Lucky man. Not too far from the Mediterranean Sea and a beautiful bit of Spain.
No, it's 25 minutes driving from here.
Oh, how lovely. Listen, you're very Catalan in lots of ways, aren't you? You were born in Catalonia, you were brought up in Catalonia, you live in Catalonia. What makes Catalonia so different from the rest of Spain?
Well, I think a part of the culture and a part of it's another country. If we talk about wines, Catalonia has a very different orography from the north to the south. So we have mountains in the Pyrenees where we can ski, and in 1 hour you can be having a sun bath in the beach, no? And it makes that we have a very different microclimates and very different regions to grow vines and to make wine.
And culturally, it's always been different from the rest of Spain, obviously with its own language and its own literature. Maybe a different way of looking things, slightly?
Well, it's the truth. So we were a different country, and obvious, all of us are Mediterranean, so in the Mediterranean, more or less, we are all the same. But in terms of culture, language, and way of doing, it's a little bit different from other parts of Spain, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you studied in Falset, which is the political capital of Priorat. Then you studied more in Tarragona and then in Villafranca del Penedès, which aren't so far away. Did you always know that you'd return to Priorat to make wine once you'd finished wine school? Was that your dream?
Well, when you are from Priorat, you have wine in your blood, you know? you have seen it from when you're born under a vine, and is the thing you can see every day. And my hope was to came to my home, to came in Priorat, to make wine here.
I mean, have you lived and worked in different countries as well as Spain?
I made a harvest in Australia, in McLaren Vale, with Mr. Stephen Pannell, a Garnacha master, where I learned a lot of things about wine and about winemaking and about what means to be in love with the vineyards and with this job.
Steve is an amazing guy, isn't he? He was a guest on Cork Talk a few months ago. Fascinating guy and very interesting, as you said. He's got a very good understanding of Garnacha. What did you learn from him about Garnacha in particular?
Well, it was for me was the first time that I saw things a little bit different from what I learned in the university and here, no? Working with open tanks, giving a lot of oxygen during fermentation to make clean wines, fermenting Garnacha at the beginning at low temperature to keep aromas. So it was a different way to understand and to find the good expression of Garnacha.
Mm. I mean, talking about Steve, the other great person you work with, a Garnacha master was Álvaro Palacios, yeah, when you were a student, one of Spain's great winemakers and somebody obviously who had an enormous influence on Priorat. Well, what did you learn from Álvaro? I mean, apart from energy, which is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
His energy.
He has a lot of energy. And one thing that I learned was the respect for this job. I mean, what means to think, or what you have to think when you are trying to make a good wine. And that means that it's not something about the person, it's about the place. And I think that he is one of the persons that that did more and is doing for Priorat. He has been our best ambassador. Mm. And this respect and this believing on what a person do is really extreme in Álvaro.
In your region, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? It's a paradox that he's such a big personality, and yet he believes in place, in allowing the place to express itself, really, that his personality, how big it is not really expressed in the wine.
He's a very good seller, too.
He's certainly a good salesman. I think that's very true, yeah. Listen, you worked at Mas Roig, yeah? I hope I've got my Catalan correct there. In Tarragona, in the cooperativa for 7 years. Cooperatives in Spain sometimes have a bad image, I think. They're often criticised. Do you think that's fair? I just wonder, what do you think makes a good cooperative? Because that is a good cooperative.
We have to think that now maybe it has changed a little bit, no? But like 20, 25 years ago, the cooperatives were the only wineries that exist in the south of Catalonia, we can say, okay? Mm. And still nowadays, they own probably the best vineyards in every town. Mm. It's true that normally cooperatives were making bulk wine, and for that, the image of these kind of companies was not so good. Mm. But when they started making bottled wine with really old vineyards and very good vineyards, I think it changed. And now, for me, there is not a big difference in terms of quality. If you taste or buy wine from a cooperative or from a private seller.
Yeah. I mean, you also did a bit of time at the Cooperativa in Montsant, which is an Capsanis, yeah? Which is an amazing cooperative as well. Much smaller cooperative, yeah?
Yeah. Capsanis was the first big company about wine in Priorat. I made there my training in 1996 with Angel Teixidó, a really good winemaker too. And I learned a lot too. While I was studying, I was doing my I don't know the word in English, my practice there. And it was funny because it was time when they were producing this kosher wine that was a completely different point of view about what we were used to see.
Mm. I mean, you then got this amazing job where you are now at Scala Dei in 2007, which is the most historic and the most famous property, really, in Priorat. I just wonder, how much did you know about its history and the vineyards and the place before you got the job? I mean, you knew its reputation, but had you actually been there and thought, whoa?
Well, for somebody who is born in Priorat, it's like a dream to go to work where everything started about wine in Priorat. Working on the wine wall, everybody knows Scala Dei in Priorat, no? You know the monastery, you know the history, you know that monks were monks that were making wine and they had vines and all that. And when you start in the wine world, then you start learning more things. And then when you have the chance to go there, it's like a dream become true. No? Mm.
I mean, I always feel when I'm there that you feel the history. I mean, it has a very strong atmosphere, that place. Do you feel that when you're working there?
Well, I'm not very superstitious but...
You're a scientist.
But there is something special. I mean... it's a kind of it's difficult to describe with words that you cannot say the superstition, but it's a kind of power there, no? In the Monson Mountain, a kind of quietness, a kind of place where things happen slowly and regularly, and you can feel that it's a really good place for matcha and for wines there.
And mostly good things. It has a, if you believe in these things, it has a good energy, I think.
Yeah. You feel quiet when you are there. I don't know. I don't believe in these things, but it's true that you feel quiet.
I mean, do you know much about what the monks were doing? I mean, they arrived in 1194. Mm-hmm. They were Carthusian monks, yeah? But did they plant vineyards immediately or not?
Yeah, well, they were who brought us the knowledge about vine growing and winemaking. And in Scladei, we are still running a vineyard that was the first place where they planted vines when they arrived. And it's a place called Pregona. That means deep funding. It's a very small valley that is protected from winds, and it's southwest facing. And they started spreading the vine growing since they arrived in 1194.
And do we know what they planted?
Well, we have some handwritten documents. In particular, we have. There is a handwritten document from a monk from the Cartoixa that was wrote in 1624. And the title is To Plant Vines in Scladei. And in 1624, there was like five centuries that they were there, no? And they had some experience about all their trials. And this document says, I will try to translate in English. When you have to plant vines in Scladei, take care because not all the grapes or all the varieties will work good there. In Scladei, due to there is a cool soil, so a cold soil, you have to plant Garnacha and Mataro. Well, Garnacha, we know what it is. Mataro probably was Monestrell. Probably was Monestrell. But we don't know it certainly. I mean, probably was Monestrell, because about the place where we are, the climate, and that Monestrell is a grape that works well in this area, no? But yeah, it was written that in Scladei we can only plant Garnacha and Mataro. And historically, it's true. For example, about the two grapes of Priorat, in Scladei has never been planted Carignana. It's too much to the north. Mm. It's too high altitude, and Carignana, it has a longer cycle to ripe. In the past, it didn't ripe enough in Scladei.
Do we know about winemaking in the monastery in the 16th, 17th century?
Well, in the same handwritten document, they explain a little bit how they used to work in terms to make white, in terms to make red wines, so using the stems, fermenting in concrete tanks, how to prepare the tanks to receive the grapes. Yeah, there is a little bit of history about this winemaking. Not all the history that we would like to know, because in 1835 the monastery was completely burned and I don't know the word saqueado, so people entered.
Yeah, burned down. It was sacked. Exactly. Sacked. Yeah.
And the bibliothèque so was completely burned. So a few documents have been left from them.
So we lost the library. Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, then as you said, there was phylloxera and the civil war, and Priorat was in decline. And by the late 1980s, it was about 600 hectares, and now you're 4,500 hectares.
Yeah.
What changed? What changed its fortune? How did it recover?
Well, when we now talking about Priorat means the political area called Priorat. In this political area called Priorat, there are two appellations: Priorat and Montsant. Okay, if we talk about before phylloxera. In this area, where we that we call Priorat, Comarca del Priorat now, there were like 18 to 20,000 hectares of vineyard planted. And in this area were like 30,000 people living. If we compare it to nowadays, between the two populations, we have 4,500 hectares of vineyards. So it means 25% of what was 125 years ago. Yeah. And there is only 10,000 people living in Priorat. In the 90s, everything changed in Priorat, because before the 90s, Priorat was the poorest region in Catalonia, so poorest than the Pyrenees regions. And thanks to the wine, Priorat is still alive nowadays. If not, probably Priorat will be a place with abandoned villages and all that. And I think it's still alive. Thanks to the wine, it has changed completely the life in the area. So probably if it wasn't for wine, I won't be here today. No, people was going away from Priorat to the big cities like Tarragona, Barcelona to work, and thanks to the wine, people is coming back to Priorat again.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, Priorat is regarded by most people as being very Mediterranean. We said that you're quite close to the Mediterranean Sea, and it can get very hot. I remember you telling me once that you finished picking at Scala Dei, I think it was 2008, on November the 4th.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is the perception we have of it as a Mediterranean region, it needs a little bit of qualifying, maybe, in a way?
Well, it's a Mediterranean region, it's true. But Priorat is located between two chain mountains, and it makes that winters are harsh than in the coast, and summer is hot, but it's drier. Okay, but Priorat has two a very different altitude range, so it makes that when you have a vineyard at 800 meters, for example, the ripening is a lot delayed. No, a part of it. It's hot, it's true, but we have the sea wind that it when it's 4 or 5 p.m. in summer, it refreshes a lot. It refreshes a lot, and it makes to go up the moisture, the humidity in the air. So
it's altitude and then sea breezes, even 45 kilometers from the Mediterranean.
Yeah, right? 25.
I mean, can you tell us a bit about the soil types? Because whenever you see a photograph of Priorat, they have these famous licoreia, you know, the schist or slate soils. But it's much more diverse than that, isn't it? Can you just tell us briefly, for somebody who doesn't know Priorat, how many different soil types there are? I mean, at Scala Dei and in the region as a whole.
Well, it's true that the most famous and most common soil in Priorat is licoreia. We call licoreia to this slate soil that give to the Priorat wines this deepness, concentration, we can say minerality or high color. No, it's a very poor soil, and in Priorat appellation, it represents probably around 90 to 95% of the soil in Priorat, with more iron, less iron, so you can find this slate, more brown, more red, more blue, but is slate. But in the edge of the Appalachian, we can find red clay soils, limestone soils, and normally these soils are in a high altitude. So when you left these hills of Licoreia and you start going up to the Montsant mountain, then you find there this red clay and limestone. And it gives a completely different profile to the wines. So we can say in general that if we can get from the slate the powerful, the deepness, the concentration, and the typicity of the wines of Priorat, when we get grapes from this clay soil and limestone, we get the finesse, the elegance, and overall the freshness and the acidity of these wines, and it matches really well.
Yeah, how much of the clay limestone do you have at Scala Dei?
In Scala Dei, we own around 50% of our vines are planted over a slate soil, where we get this typicity from Priorat. And the other 50% of our Garnacha is planted over red clay and limestone. So it's if we compare the wines of Scalae to the wines made in the center of Priorat, where you only can get grapes from slate, probably the wines from Scalae are a little bit less concentrate, so a little bit less of body, but with more tension, with more acidity, so a lower pH, and these wines looks like young for more times and normally ages really well.
Yeah, and they have often pale color, don't they? Some of your wines.
Yeah, are not as deep in color than in the slate, or if you have 100% slate.
And I mean, some people don't know this, but you make a white wine as well, a very good white wine called Massipa. Yeah, and the blend is really unusual and maybe unique. Yeah. I think in Priorat, just tell us what's in it. I mean, it's an amazing blend.
Yeah, white in Priorat it's not very common. 90% or more than 90% of the wines in Priorat are red, but there are always some white vineyards, and in Scalae we have one white vineyard. That's called Massipa, and it's very special because it's a very high altitude. It's planted at 700 meters and east facing, so it means that you can avoid the afternoon and evening sun in summer. That it means that the skin is not sunburned. You can keep acidity, and the blend is 80% Garnacha, white Garnacha. That's usual in our area, and 20% Chenin Blanc. And you say Chenin Blanc, how it's possible, no? Because a part of it, it's like a grape from the south west of France, blended with a grape from the northeast of France. So it's very. But yeah, it seems that at the beginning of the 80s, one of the owners of Scalae was asking somebody that he don't remembers who. What to plant to blend with Garnacha to get some acidity to make it more vibrant, more alive. And this person that we don't know who was told him, try to plant Chenin. It will help you with the acidity. And it's true, it works. And what we do is that we pick it together to take advantage of the acidity of Chenin when it's not perfectly ripe. Yeah. And we pick it together with Garnacha when it's ripe. So
most of what you have, 80% is Garnacha, and Garnacha is sometimes called the Pinot Noir of the South, right? Is that a good description of the grape for you? I mean, it's quite delicate, isn't it? Despite the alcohol it often has.
It can be. I mean, when you have to compare with another one, normally it's not a good idea. But if we talk in terms of elegance, finesse, I think Garnacha can be on the podium of these top vedette grapes of the world. No? But for me, the big difference between Garnacha and Pinot Noir is that Garnacha lacks in tannin. So Pinot Noir has more tannin on the skin and on the seeds than Garnacha. And then if you want to make a wine on the same characteristics or a wine to age in bottle for some years, you have to think how to help Garnacha on getting this tannin and make this balance in the wine. And in Scalae, we do it with the stems. So in the high altitude, when it's time to pick, we have ripe skin. That's what we want to make a wine. But at the same time, we have ripe stems. And these stems helps us giving this extra amount of tannin, and then we can be at the same level of, or we can be the Pinot Noir of the South.
Okay, interesting. So your tannin comes from the seeds and from the stems more than from the skins. Really?
Yeah, it depends on the Garnacha. For example, in Masdeu, is a more powerful Garnacha. But in the red clay, the Garnacha is not as powerful than in the limestone. So then the stems helps us a lot to build up the wine.
Yeah, you have this very interesting theory about Garnacha following the Ebro River, don't you? That do you think that Garnacha moved almost with the river. Do you think it was transported along the river in boats or something?
There are two theories about how Garnacha arrived to Priorat. Okay, the more romantic one is that it arrived with the monks on their trip by the southwest of France. So if we cross the Pyrenees and we go to Languedoc-Roussillon or there, is where we can find Garnacha and Carignana planted together, no? Maybe the more technical one is that if we look historically where Garnacha has been planted, Garnacha and Carignana has been planted together in the Iberian Peninsula, is following the Ebro River. So we find Garnacha and Mazuelo in Rioja. We find Garnacha in Navarra. So going down, we find Garnacha and Carignana in Aragon, and then we arrive to Tarragona. So historically, the places where Garnacha was more, let's say, planted or more present was in the Ebro River Valley. Yeah. So we can choose within these two different theories how Garnacha get to Priorat, but I think that the more logical is that in all the Ebro River Valley was planted Garnacha historically from centuries.
And maybe the monks brought Pinot Noir rather than Garnacha, and then it didn't work.
Maybe, but we don't know. Right now. Or 100 years ago, was not Pinot and Priorat, no? I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Maybe they make some trails and it didn't work here.
It didn't work, yeah. I mean, you've mentioned Masdéu, your highest site for Garnacha, and I think your best site for Garnacha. Can you just tell us, was that a historic site? Was that something that the monks planted? Or is it something you've developed?
No. It was a historic site. In Scaldei, we know... And we are managing five vineyards that we know that were planted with Garnacha at least in 1624.
Wow.
And obviously, the plants are not the same from 1624 because the phylloxera. But yes, about these handwritten documents, we know that Masdéu was a place... where they had Garnacha planted, like San Antoni, like Pregona, like Artigots. And they ordered to build there a mas. A mas is a Catalan county house. So, and they ordered to build there a mas to put a pair of families living there to take care of that vineyard. That was a really good place for Garnacha. So the only thing we are doing is trying to keep a legacy and trying to protect it and let it for the future.
Preserve history in a way, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you've talked a little bit about Carignan, Monastrell, which is not grown at Scaldei, but is obviously grown in Priorat. And you've got one wine that you make, Heredje, which is a heretic. Yeah, it's made just from Carignan, isn't it? Do you think you're going to plant Carignana now with climate change, with these warmer temperatures, even at Scaldei?
It's a question that we are making ourselves in Scaldei the last years. It's true that historically Carignana didn't work well in Scaldei due to the altitude and due to the being in the northern part of Priorat. But it's true too that the climate is changing. And as in the 70s, the harvest started the first week of October in Scaldei. We are starting now the 18th, the 20th of September. So it means that the harvest has been advanced. It makes that probably Carignana can ripe now in Scaldei. Okay? And that wine that you were saying, Redge, Rethic, it's called like that because it's something that goes against the rules to make a Carignana wine in the best place for Garnacha in Priorat, no? But at the same time, this wine is like a homenaje, like
A homage. Yeah.
Yeah, homage. Yeah. To that people that during the first half of the 20th century Imperial Art, that was probably the darkest part of the history in Imperial Art, were the people who resist and who maintained this tradition of viticulture, this tradition of winemaking in Imperial Art, because they had no other thing to do at the morning than go to the vineyard that was being planted by his father or his grandfather and preserve it. And when Priorat started to become famous at the beginning of the 90s, in Priorat only left 600 hectares of vineyard. And making...
Most of it very small, right? Small parcels, yeah.
Yeah, very small, in steep slopes. And this wine that's made with four very small pieces of Coste, of these steep slopes, that the youngest one planted in 1918 and the oldest one planted in 1908, just after phylloxera attack, is a kind of homage to these people that maintained these vineyards during decades. And without these people, probably we won't be talking today about Priorat wine.
Started at the end of the 80s with Alvaro and René Barbier and various other people. And then people started being a bit more Bordeaux focused, even planting Cabernet Sauvignon. What happened to that? I mean, do you think that changed the character of the region with smaller oak and different grape varieties and a different mindset, a different way of thinking?
Yeah. Look, Priorat is a very old region if we talk about vine growing. Okay, we can go back to the 12th century. But in the 90s, Priorat was a very, 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 very young region about bottled wine. The first bottled wine was made in Scala in 1974. But until beginning of the 90s, there were just three wineries bottling wine in Priorat. So when Priorat started to become famous, it's like the humans, no? What does the child do? What the adults does. And in the 90s, who were the adults? The adults were Bordeaux, and Priorat was a child. And what did Priorat? Start planting Cabernet Sauvignon, start planting Merlot, start planting Cabernet Franc. And if you compare the wines made in the 90s in Priorat to the wines that are making Priorat now, it's a big change. It's true that from 2004, 2005, there was general thinking that changed mine, and more or less people said, okay, if we want to be somebody on the wine wall, what we cannot do is to copy another region, no? We have to show what we are, and we are Slate, we are Clay, we are Garnacha, and we are Carignana. And probably the wines from nowadays in Priorat are a little bit lighter in body, but for me, the wines from nowadays in Priorat are a lot easier to identify from Priorat than the wines made in the 90s. I believe that the wines made in the 90s, if you take a Super Tuscany and a wine made in Priorat in the 90s with 50, 60, 70% Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, you can be really confused about which one, no?
I mean, you've mentioned this wine, Cartoche, in 1974, made at Scala Dei, which was the first modern Priorat in many ways, really. I just wonder, have you tasted it? What's it taste like? Is it still good?
Yeah, it is. we still have some bottles. I have to say that probably it's better 75. So 74 was a very good year for people. I was born in 74, but not for wine. about the wines from the 70s that we have in Scala Dei, 75, 78 are better than 74. But 74, if you are lucky, because for every 10 bottles, probably four of them are really good. You can have a really good time drinking this wine.
And it was made in a traditional way, was it, with whole bunches, with stems, and with old wood?
Yeah. It was made on the ancestral way, or on the way that the monks worked during centuries. So explaining it very shortly is without destemming, fermenting in concrete or stone tanks, without temperature control, with natural yeast, and aging in not the typical French barrique of 225 liters. So the wine was kept or aged in big foudres or big oak tanks, and normally old ones.
How fascinating. I'd love to try it. Next time I'm there, maybe you can open a bottle.
I think it will remain some bottle. yeah.
Okay, fantastic. We've got to try one. Listen, final question. It's been fantastic talking to you. I've learned so much. I just want to know, how do you get away from wine? I mean, do you like reading? You live in a beautiful region. Do you like cycling, walking, or is wine your life?
Well, it's wine too. I like to drink wine, but not the wine that I make. I like a lot to go to hike in mountains with my wife and the child. We used to escape to the Pyrenees, or in summer we try to go to the Alps and do hikings. Some years ago, I used to run mountain running, but now I was injured and I cannot. I tried mountain bike, but it's not the same than running. And I like a lot. I enjoy a lot hiking on mountains and climb.
It's an amazing mountain to climb on, the mountain behind Galadé, isn't it?
Yeah, Montsant, but high one than Pyrenees. I like high mountain. Yeah,
you're a serious hiker. Right?
I like a lot.
Listen, Ricard, it's been fantastic talking to you. I love what you're doing. I think that the quality of an expression of this historic place is improving with every vintage with what you're doing. It's been great talking to you. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your passion with us. And it's been lovely to talk to you. See you soon.
Thank you. Thank you to your team. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I've always been a fan of what the monks achieved in the wine world, and they certainly got the right answer with Garnacha in Priorat. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Aubrey Beeslar from Canonkop in Stellenbosch. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.